making a huge plan of a school massacre. They had identified three staff members at the school by name that they were targeting, along with some random students, as they called it. They just wanted to, as they put it, they just wanted to kill as many people as possible.
South Pasadena Police Chief Arthur Miller this morning commenting on a foiled mass shooting at South Pasadena High School. Two students are in custody. They had talked about what they wanted to do online, and school administrators alerted police, who say the threat was credible. So if indeed it was credible, this would seem to be a case of preventative police work. But many schools are going beyond prevention. They're arming their in-house police officers with assault rifles and body armor. This summer, the Compton School Board approved a policy which allows their police officers to purchase semi-automatic AR-15 rifles. And Compton's not the only district buying AR-15s for school officers. The Los Angeles School Police has them. So do the police in Baldwin Park, Santa Ana, Fontana, and San Bernardino. Joining us now is Todd DeMitchell. He's professor of education and justice studies at the University of New Hampshire. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Well, how common is this, arming school police with semi-automatic rifles?
It's a fairly recent occurrence. There have been instances where police have been have had that kind of weaponry, which may be a part of their normal police duties, which may be in the police car. But this is a response to specifically to rampage shootings that have taken place, particularly since Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre.
And these police officers, these school police officers, are they trained in how to use these weapons?
Yeah, they're right. Yes, this is part of their normal of their police training, since they are issued by as part of their equipment from the police department. They would need to be properly trained.
And any evidence that arming school police officers in this way helps to prevent violence?
There's nothing that I've read on that. You know, one of the arguments would be that it hasn't been around long enough in which you can actually gather data. And the other part is that you have to gather data on a negative. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, we have over 95,000 public schools attended by 50 million students. With 95,000 schools, we ask, what is the prevalence of rampage shootings at school? And so that number is extremely small. So to try to get at that, it was the presence that there are the fact that a school resource officer had a AR-15 in his or her trunk of the car is what has made the school safer. It's going to be a hard that's going to be some hard research to try to prove.
Right. Well, what about during a shooting, a mass shooting? Is having an AR-15 an advantage for police officers?
Well, it's interesting. When you take a look at the shootings themselves, they last on average 12 minutes, with about 37% of the time they occur in 5 minutes or less. So a police officer who has an AR-15 in his or her police car has got to leave the school and go to wherever the police car is situated, retrieve the AR-15, come back into the school, locate the shooter at that point. So time, since one of the arguments is that time is of the essence, that seems to reasonably would increase the amount of time. Some of the schools, such as in Gainesville, Georgia, have set up biometric technology, and they have their AR-15s. In gun safes in the school itself. Mm. And there are several others that have done that, which would seem to argue that that you could get the Fontana does that also. They would have access to the rifles in a much quicker fashion. The other thing to think of, one of the other arguments, or two arguments for having the AR-15s, one, greater firepower in response to the individual who has invaded the school or is a class, you know, it's a classmate at the school, and so they have enough firepower to respond to. That's one argument. The it's a response time, it's the second one. And then when you take a look at the shootings themselves, one of the arguments against the handgun is not only the differential in power, but the accuracy of it. I'm not a gun expert, so I'm only going by what I read, that handguns are only that their accuracy drops off tremendously at 25 yards. I've read stuff that says even less than that. So the question becomes, what is the distance in which you would need the firearm to be fairly accurate? And so if a AR 15 is accurate to 200 yards, how often are we engaging individuals at 200 yards in a school shooting?
Right, and then what are the odds then, or the risks then, to students that?
That's exactly right. That's one of the other things that comes up. It's the, and once again, I'm not a weapons expert. So I'm only speaking from a limited knowledge. But the issue of the load of the bullet, how heavy the bullet is. So if you've got handguns, there's special ammunition that is being used for police officers who are in the schools, resource officers in the schools, so that it doesn't have great penetrating power and will go through an individual and then endanger lots of other students. Schools are crowded places.
Right, right. So what is the point then of these AR-15s? Why are school districts giving their police officers these guns?
In some ways, it's a nice sounding argument for the adults. We have really made this, we've hardened the site, we've made this a much more secure site. We now have met force with force. The quote, the bad guy is carrying these a lot of heavy weaponry, and therefore we have to meet it. When you take a look at the kinds of shootings that have been going on, there's two fairly recent ones in which the students did have AR-15s, and there are two where they have the shotguns. Actually, they sawed off the shotguns. But quite often they'll be using handguns. So the AR-15 is so that we have to match firepower, and most of the time these are, you know, our kids. You know, we don't have that many intruders like out of Newtown that are coming in that are well skilled and well trained. You know, that are storming our schools. I mean, it just is not the reality of rampage shootings.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, sure. Thank you very much.
That's Todd DeMitchell, Professor of Education and Justice Studies at the University of New Hampshire. Well, what do you think? Should school police be armed with AR-15 rifles in case there's a mass shooting, or should school districts invest their money elsewhere? What do you think? Are our schools safe? Do they need to be safer? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can join the conversation on Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Well, LAUSD has the biggest school police department in the country. There are 350 armed officers, but now they will no longer arrest students for minor offenses. A new policy announced today says police will not cite kids for things like campus fights, graffiti, petty theft, or being caught with alcohol or cigarettes. And here's what Superintendent John Daisy said to Channel 7.
We do not accept the behavior, but our response is not to immediately criminalize. We have been dropping our suspension rates dramatically. We want to continue to do the same thing with our citation rates.
Manuel Criollo is the community rights campaign organizer. His organization has been involved in the negotiations that led to these new policies, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Well, it's my pleasure. And so what are the offenses that students will not be cited or arrested for now?
Well, the first thing, before I get to that, I think this is an important victory for, you know, young people, youth, and community organizations that have been trying to move the needle around what has been coined the school-to-prison pipeline here in Los Angeles and across the country. And in many ways, this is a story about young people, you know, telling us their stories, you know, recruiting other young people to for other young people to take action and to change the kind of policies that we saw. So as we know, here in Los Angeles, we have the largest school police department. In many ways, what played out was that between 2009 and 2011, over 33,000 tickets were given to young people in school. Over 40% of those were to children 14 and younger. And of course, you know, just as, you know, the racialized nature of most policing, that, you know, black children and Latino children were, you know, had high rates of criminalization that played out. And so this new policy is sort of basically a step-by-step guideline for police to prevent sort of 9 different tickets or arrests that were playing out in our schools. There were things like possession of alcohol, possession of tobacco, vandalism of district property, trespassing, petty theft, fights, and batteries. You know, again, in many ways, our schools didn't have sort of an equal sort of set of expectations. And what would play out was that a school in South Los Angeles, a fight would ensue, and, you know, automatically, or most of the time, it would end up with a disturbing the peace ticket or an actual arrest for battery, which meant the young person was, you know, arrested, handcuffed, went to court. In contrast to maybe a school somewhere else in the district where that young person would probably only be suspended or told, hey, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, these are the new protections. You know, there's an important diversion for the young people who used to get arrested would now go to these family source centers that the city and the district will be handling these young people to get to sort of the core issues of what was playing out, of why they're acting out and what was the origin of the fight.
So then what is the purpose of having police on campus?
Well, you know, I think that's a big philosophical question. You know,
well, if they're no longer going to be arresting students,
at least,
and
you know,
citing
one for LA, if you read the new directive, it's very clear that it's saying that they're there for, you know, emergency response and, you know, sort of life-threatening sort of situations, and that, you know, at least what played out over the last many years was that law enforcement was inadvertently, or at, you know, or, you know, or being pushed to actually, you know, do school discipline when you had less adults in the playground. And so I think in this way, this new policy is trying to at least both clarify to the school police officers their role and also remind the administration themselves and the school that, you know, the schools have other set of tools that can easily resolve many of the issues that young people were being caught up for.
Was this difficult in terms of getting the district to change its policy?
Well, you know, the district has been in a massive shift around how they engage issues around zero tolerance and school discipline. And particularly when we are trying to address also the way that race plays out in the discriminatory sort of impacts of which children were being punished. And so the district, you know, over 7 years ago adopted a positive discipline sort of policy. And last year, you know, many of the community rights campaign with other allies like the Dignity in Schools campaign and Brothers Sons Selves passed the, you know, very breakthrough policy called the School Climate Bill of Rights that, it, you know, got the LAUSD to adopt things like restorative justice to, you know, sort of ban the use of willful defiance suspensions that were particularly impacting African-American youth. So I think it's just an important wave of what's happening. But more importantly, I think there's a real civil rights on-the-ground movement that's really trying to end the criminalization of young people in schools, and that just like your earlier segment was talking, that in many ways both our schools and our playgrounds have been either militarized or have become sort of minefields of penal code violations. And so we're trying to reverse sort of that culture. And it's really been sort of a movement on the ground from every major city, from probably any small town, who have been rejecting sort of the policies that have played out. And, of course, the consequences is you have, you know, some of the highest sort of incarceration rates in the world. And mm-hmm. we can't sort of separate what treatment young people were receiving in school or how schools were criminalizing everyday behavior and sending it to the criminal justice system and not then be surprised that we have 2.4 million people in prison. And so I think in that sense, you know, the district is playing an important role in taking up a lot of leadership sort of to shift that wave that we've gone through. And obviously it's tough when we consider much of what we still need, which is real resources in our schools.
Right, right. Well, at the same time, though, you do have some very real issues playing out in some of our schools with kids sometimes bringing weapons to school, with gang activity in schools, with bullying, with all sorts of behavior that can occur. when there isn't a lot of discipline and or, you know, or for other reasons. So how, what's the best way to combat that kind of, those kinds of problems?
Well, I think much of what LUSD is trying to implement and much of what many of the community groups and the young people have been advocating, we believe that to have long-term sort of safety issues, long-term sort of shift in school climate, that you have to incorporate everybody. You have to incorporate the parents, you have to incorporate the teachers, and you got to incorporate the young people themselves to set those expectations, to be held accountable. But the accountability doesn't have to come primarily through the criminal justice system. The accountability can come through restorative justice circles. The accountability can come from creating real expectations and that, you know, discipline will equally be meted out to everybody. But what we've seen for too long, you know, has been these sort of zero tolerance policies and practices that, one, we think ultimately are not working. Two, that really doesn't get to the root cause of why young people are acting up. And three, that we can't sort of separate then the vacuum of the real set of de-investment that's happened in our neighborhoods and communities. You know, you can't, you know, we have a $2 billion investment in LAPD and only $24 million for any type of youth alternatives. That's not even equally sort of surpassed. So I think, you know, we think this is an important breakthrough, right, in the wave of what we've seen for a long time. But there's going to be a lot of work that needs to be done.
Manuel Criollo is Director of Organizing at the Community Rights Campaign. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. Well, have you seen an increased police presence in your child's school? Do you think we need to have cops on campus? What's your reaction? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the most expensive car on earth, why Ferraris are the it car for the 1%, and rating the cars for clunkers program from 5 years ago. Did it save the auto industry? Car news is next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The most expensive car ever sold at auction went for $38 million last week. And that number was disappointingly low for some car collectors. Matt DeBoer joins us now to talk about the most extravagant wheels on the road and how the junkiest of clunkers may have saved the auto industry. Matt is transportation editor for Business Insider, and he's our go-to guy for all things automobile. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, tell us about this $38 million car. Was it made entirely of gold?
It was not made entirely of gold. In fact, I don't think there was an ounce of gold in it. But it is a red Ferrari 250 GT Berlinetta. From the early 60s, and it sold for $38 million at auction. It is the highest value that's ever been a car's been sold for at auction. This is just incredible. Although some people expected that this car would sell for $50 million, maybe more. So in some respects, it's a bit of a disappointment.
Is that a bubble, or are these cars considered worth that much money?
You know, I think there's perhaps a bit of a Ferrari bubble right now. That was the big story that came out of the auctions that were held last week and over the weekend. It was just a total Ferrari-palooza as far as the auctions were concerned. Ferraris were just selling for $1 million, $10 million, $12 million, $20 million, this one for $38 million. Ferraris have become the absolute top of the pile as far as the collectible car world is concerned. So if you're trying to amass a really respectable collection of collectible cars, to go along with your art collection and your wine collection and all the other things that you collect, you're going to be going for Ferraris. And it's a real seller's market right now. If somebody Madeline, if you happen to have a Ferrari from the mid-50s,
I have a Jetta from the mid-2000s. Is that what?
It's just not the same.
No.
It's just not the same as a vintage Ferrari. But should you happen to have one of these, you know, under a sheet in your garage and you want to pull it out, this is a great time to be selling it because it's really what the collectors want. This is not to say that there aren't other classic cars that collectors love to, you know, pay a lot for at auction as well. But right now, it just seems like the Ferraris were the big story going into these auctions, and Ferraris have been the big story coming out of the auctions.
So this happened at something called the Monterey Car Week, and this was an event that used to be open for all car collectors, but it sounds like you have to have a lot of money to be bidding.
You know, Monterey Car Week is a sort of week-long festival of cars. It's held up in Northern California. The centerpiece of the whole event is this thing called the Concours d'Elegance, the Pebble Beach Concours d'Elegance. And that's essentially just a parade of classic cars. It's been going on since the 50s, and it used to be that there was a little car race that they would have, kind of an amateur car race. And then they would have this event where all the people who collect classic cars got to, you know, parade their cars around. Everybody was, lots of fun and parties and, you know, cocktails and that sort of thing. And that still goes on. You can still go up there and show off your classic car. But increasingly what's happened is the event has become about these auctions that surround it. And a variety of auction houses, you know, use the lead up to the event to sort of promote the cars that they're going to be auctioning off and talk about how much they're going to sell for. And, very wealthy collectors, you know, make a week of it. They go and they stroll around and they have parties and they drink cocktails. And increasingly what it's become is this sort of auto show for the 1%. People who are very, very wealthy don't go to the LA Auto Show. They don't go to the Detroit Auto Show. They don't want to look at the latest pickup truck or the latest minivan or the latest mass market sedan. They want to buy Ferraris and Porsches and high-end Mercedes and things like that. And even Lamborghinis, the very most spectacular and fancy of the high-end automobiles. These are the new cars. You know, these aren't the cars that they have stashed away in their collections that they don't really drive. They just sort of rub them with a diaper periodically and gaze upon them, and feel really great about themselves. It has become kind of an event for them. And this, may be in some respects kind of alienating the old line, single car collector who might have just been a regular middle class Joe who loved cars.
Okay, well, let's move from those to the other end of the spectrum and talk about clunkers. And a lot of people have been crunching the numbers on that Cash for Clunkers program that the president unveiled back in 2009. During the financial collapse. And this was a program where the government would give you a bunch of money to turn in your old car for a new car. So why is everyone looking back at this now? Is it a five-year mark? Is that why?
Well, basically what's going on is that the car industry was in horrible shape back then. I mean, 2009, it was dark, dark days. I mean, Chrysler had gone bankrupt. GM had gone bankrupt. Ford was, on death's door. It was just looking awful. The Japanese and all the other car makers weren't doing any better. The market was horrible. So the government needed to do something to stimulate economic activity, and they came up with Cash for Clunkers. So take your junky car and trade it in. So what's going on now, though, 5 years later, is that the car business is doing fantastically well. They're selling cars left and right. I mean, it's just the business is booming. It's great. So it's the ideal opportunity for people to look back and say, well, when did it turn? When did things change? When did we realize that there was light at the end of this dark tunnel and that the American car business and, the larger auto industry wasn't just going to completely collapse? So a couple of academics at Texas A&M produced this study, which has got a great title called Cash for Corollas When Stimulus Reduces Spending. And their argument is essentially that, sure, people traded in their junky old cars for shiny new cars back then, took advantage of the incentives that the government was offering, but they didn't buy expensive cars, and they didn't buy, more importantly, the sort of hybrid vehicles that the government wanted them to buy, the Priuses and hybrid Camrys and things like that. They bought little, cheap, small cars. And so their argument is that this decimated the amount of money that the car makers could have made back then. I mean, their argument is that the car makers lost $3 billion that they could have made if people had bought cars that were more expensive.
But is there
an
argument?
Completely buy
it. Was there an argument that they would have bought those more expensive cars anyway?
Well, it's unclear. The idea is, if you were going to buy a car, right, the real crux of the issue is the government kind of tried to kill two birds with one stone. What they tried to do was restart the auto industry, but they also tried to get people to buy more fuel-efficient vehicles. What people wound up doing was buying these $20,000 and less cars. And so the effect was that, people bought cars, but they bought these little cheapo cars. And I don't completely buy it because I think there's a larger issue at play here. When you look back at the Cash for Clunkers period and the dark days of the auto industry, you have to remember that there was also the economy was awful at the time as well. And there was no credit available, right? Credit had completely locked up because of the financial crisis. So, and when people buy a car, they don't, even if you're buying a $15,000 or $20,000 car, you generally don't walk in with $15,000 or $20,000 and say, here's my pile of money, give me a car. You finance it. Mm-hmm. You get a car loan. So at the time, Cash for Clunkers also had the beneficial effect of getting credit going in the economy again. So when I look back at cash flow clunkers, I say, yeah, that's probably true what these guys are saying, these academics. You know, I've looked at the study and I think they're accurate in terms of their analysis. But what they're overlooking is that there was a follow-on effect, which was that cash flow clunkers got credit moving in the U.S. economy again. So I don't think it necessarily just saved the auto industry. I think it actually may have saved the entire economy. It was the only good thing happening in the economy in the 2009 period. The recession was ending as far as the economists were concerned, but nobody could tell. It didn't feel like the recession was ending. It felt awful. This was a bright spot, and it really kickstarted the whole economy. So I think that's the larger issue here to think about.
Well, thanks, Matt.
Outstanding. Thank you, Madeline.
That's Matt DeBoer, transportation editor for Business Insider. Coming up, is going to an Ivy League college worth it? One former insider says no, that our elite universities are attracting and turning out young people who do not know how to think. The author of the book Excellent Sheep, after a news update with KCRW's Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Branwell. A new school year is upon us, and if you're one of the very, very, very lucky few college freshmen, you're headed to an elite university, maybe Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford. Although, maybe you're not so lucky. William Derozowitz argues that those top schools turn out a graduate who is afraid to think, in fact, can't think, and is unprepared to live a full, exciting life. His new book is called Excellent Sheep: The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks very much for having me on.
Well, it's quite a provocative title. Are you saying that all of these students who go to these elite universities are, in essence, sheep?
I'm certainly not saying that all of them are. I think a lot of them are. I think the system is geared to produce kids like the kind that you described. This has a lot to do with how kids are prepared to get into these schools. I would say even more than what happens at the schools themselves. It's that whole kind of hoop-jumping childhood that is geared towards culminating in the admissions process for Ivy League colleges that produces the kinds of kids I'm talking about and the kinds of kids that I saw during 10 years of teaching at Yale.
So they're excellent in so many ways, these kids, and they have accomplished so much. Are they a lot different than freshmen from a generation ago?
Well, you know, I think the system has been in place for a long time. I think we've started to notice this recently because it just keeps getting worse and worse. I went to high school in the late 70s, and I remember the kids who got into the best schools had like 3 AP courses and 3 extracurriculars. And now you need 7, 8, 9 AP courses and 10, 11, 12 extracurriculars. So it's just gotten so much more intense. But none of this is about learning how to think for yourself, and specifically about learning how to think about your own life for yourself.
But when they get to school, I understand that when you're a teenager, when you're a child, maybe you don't know to follow your bliss and you don't have the confidence to choose your own path. You're pretty much doing what your parents and your teachers tell you to do for most of your childhood. But when they Right. get to school, when they become adults, they're 18 years old plus, and they get to college, their first time maybe living alone, they do have the opportunity to direct their own lives. And what you're saying is they just don't know how to do that or don't want to do that?
Yes, yes, exactly right. They have not been equipped to do that. If I could just go back to what you said before, that generally speaking, you know, up until age 18, you do what your parents and teachers tell you. I don't think that that's entirely true. And certainly there are educational models that are much more about self-direction among kids. Mm. I think they maybe tend to get stereotyped as like hippie school, Montessori or whatever. But that's a lot of what it's about, is about teaching self-reliance, initiative, in an age-appropriate way.
So what happens but when those I don't think kids it's a, yeah. get to these schools? Do they have a different experience?
I'm not sure because I didn't meet a lot of them. Hmm. I will say that the few kids I met who did seem more self-directed often had somewhat, you know, non-traditional educations, or they had parents who were unusually cool, let's just say, in the sense of being relaxed about their kid's future, relaxed enough to know, in other words, listen, my kid is bright, my kid is energetic. If I let my kid sort of find their way, they're going to do great.
You have a portion in the book where you talk about the admissions process, which I found fascinating because you pull back the curtain as to how certain kids get into these schools. And really, you've got a pool of, again, excellent students to choose from. So what are the criteria to gain admittance to Yale?
They are trying to find kids who have a spark. And I think that they manage to do that some of the time. But that's after you clear the bar that I've just been talking about. I mean, when we got a kid who had six or seven extracurriculars, that was a negative. That's like, oh, that's not that many. They must kind of not be that. They're not our kind of kid. They're not energetic enough. They're not trying hard enough, right? I mean, it's crazy. If you're a typical middle-class suburban kid who's not a great athlete or like the best junior violinist in the country, that 7 or 8% admissions rate is probably a lot lower.
But they're also looking for someone who has a particular gift as well, someone who is focused and someone who's truly excellent at one particular thing.
The term of art is not well-rounded but well-lopsided, so that you're lopsided in the sense that you're already pointed in a certain direction. But then there's the well part. You have to be great at everything else. I mean, if you are the winner of the Intel Science Talent Search, which used to be called the Westinghouse, if you're that good at science, or if you are a musician who really has the promise of a concert career, then some of that other stuff doesn't have to be there. But for most kids, the overwhelming majority of kids, you've got to be great at everything and then really great, you know, or really interested in one or two particular things. And that's the problem, is that having to be great at everything thing. Like, if you know that you want to be a journalist or a poet or even a lawyer, do you really need to take calculus? Do you really need to get an A in AP calculus, a 5? Well, actually, you do, if you want to get into an Ivy League school.
So it must be just overwhelming for these kids. I mean, that's a lot of pressure for them. It's no surprise, then, that they just put their heads down and their nose to the grindstone, and they just jump through these hoops, to put three cliches together in one sentence.
That's okay. That's all right.
Talk about not being
all the
myself.
Cliches apply here.
but seriously, that's a lot of pressure. And so it doesn't surprise me that if the goal is to get into an Ivy League, that you've got kids who are more conformist than not, because how else are they going to get in?
Well, that's true, but that's exactly the problem. And also, if you look at the leadership class that these schools have been giving us for the last 10, 20, 30 years, I think that's exactly what we see. We see so-called leaders who are narrowly focused, timid, risk-averse, self-serving, and very out of touch with everybody else, which is why I think our institutions are failing. This also produces an enormous amount of mental psychological distress. Mm-hmm. You know, a Yale student wrote in rebuttal to the excerpt that was just published of this book a few weeks ago. And he said it in passing at a different connection, that half of Yale students now go to the counseling service at some point in college. Half of them seek mental health help.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with William Jerozowicz. He's the author of a new book. It's called Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. At the root of all this, though, isn't it a fundamental fear of not getting ahead or of not having what you had when you were growing up? I mean, in this economy, it's very difficult these days for anybody, including college graduates. And so isn't there this kind of fear that's driving this, that, oh, I have to get into one of these elite schools because if I don't, then I've got a scary life ahead of me financially?
Yes and no. Fundamentally, I think especially if you look at who goes to these schools, this is sort of about rearranging the chairs in the upper middle class. This is really not about people trying to climb up from the working class or even the broad middle class. But you're right. Families are scared. People think this is the only way to succeed. So it's important to know that there is a very well-researched study that says if you get into one of these schools, or even if you just apply, which I think is remarkable, you will make the same amount of money in your life no matter where you go. Okay, so you can get into Princeton, but if you go to Penn State, it doesn't matter, at least in terms of the money you make. And the reason it doesn't matter is that you're the same smart, energetic, ambitious kid. I mean, yes, it's important to be smart, motivated, energetic, not to be a slacker, to take your studies seriously, to take your career seriously. What doesn't matter for most kids is where you end up going to college. It does matter, I should say, for the poorest kids and for kids from communities of color, because it seems to have to do with making connections. But if you're a typical middle-class white kid, which quite frankly is the typical kid who goes, it actually doesn't matter.
But it's also about the college experience and who you're going to college with and the connections, to be crass about it, that you make when you're in college.
Yeah.
Connections that might serve you for the rest of your life, not only with your teachers, but more importantly with your fellow students. And isn't that part of it? And also part of being amongst people who are stimulating and interesting and smart, and perhaps that happens maybe outside the classroom, more of that kind of independent thinking. I don't know.
The first part of what you said is absolutely true. I was talking, that study I was talking about before has to do with how much money you make. If you want to be injected at high speed into the upper echelons of the American elite, then yeah, you should probably go to an Ivy League school or Stanford or something like that. If you want that status, if you want that access, there's no doubt that choosing not to go to a school like that means giving something up. The question is, at what cost? And if it's at the cost of being miserable or of being a conformist or of really, for psychological reasons, not being able to do any of the many things that may be the real thing that you ought to be doing. Maybe your real calling is to be a teacher. Maybe your real calling is to be a clergyman. I don't know. Then you're not going to be able to do that. The other point is, you know, but aren't you going to be among all these amazing kids? Well, but they're the kids we just described. Are they amazing? Or are they competitive, backstabbing, elbow-throwing careerists, as opposed to the kinds of kids that you might encounter? I mean, you've got some great liberal arts colleges down in L.A. There's Reed College up here in Portland. There are great colleges in the Midwest, in the Northeast, throughout the country, where kids are really smart and they're really interested in intellectual things, much more, I think, than the average Ivy Leaguer.
So what you're saying is that the instructors or the professors, they're not demanding that these kids, now adults, young adults, think independently for themselves? Are they not then giving them a real cold, hard lesson in the life of the mind? Is that not happening on elite college campuses?
Right. That's not happening. The model for an elite college, an elite university especially, for the faculty is we want the best scholars, researchers, scientists, social scientists, et cetera, in the world, in their fields. And that's what we're going to reward them for. Being known as a good teacher can hurt you when it comes to tenure time.
How is that?
Because if you're a good teacher, you must not be focused on your scholarship.
Hmm.
I mean, there are lots and lots of famous minds at famous universities who are terrible teachers.
You spent 10 years at Yale teaching, and you're no longer there. Why did you leave?
I didn't get tenure. I didn't get tenure because I spent a lot of time in my teaching, which is why I'm more aware of what's going on with students than most professors. It was a choice that I made, and I knew that it was probably going to hurt me professionally, but it's what I really cared about.
And, I mean, do you see yourself as a symptom of the larger problem that you're talking about? When you don't play the game, you're shut out.
Well, but I'm also, I mean, I feel very happy and fulfilled right now. That was 6 years ago. I'm a full-time writer now. And I was also very happy and fulfilled when I was an academic because I was focused on the things that I cared about. I mean, you have to make compromises. I also made compromises. A compromise means you really know what you care about and you're going to do as much of the other thing as you have to so that you can do the thing that you care about. That's different from giving up or being so cynical that you just say, listen, it's all about making money anyway. I might as well just go to Wall Street, which is what a lot of kids say. And it's kind of sad.
Okay, so let's say a high school senior is listening to you right now and deciding where to apply to school. What's your advice?
Well, I would say don't do what most kids do, which is automatically go to the most prestigious school you get into. Don't even apply to schools based on how prestigious they are. Don't worry about where your peers are talking about going. Think about what you want to get out of college. what's important to you. Think about who you are and what you think you might want to do in college and afterwards. And then really take the time to investigate options you might not have thought of. Apparently, very few kids on campus tours actually sit in on classes. They go look at the dorms, they go look at the gym, the cafeteria. Forget about that stuff. That's not what matters. That's just the bells and whistles. Try to find a place that's really serious about educating you as a person.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
That's William Derezowitz. He's the author of Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. All right. Warren Olney, not a sheep, but certainly excellent, is here to tell us what's on at 1 o'clock.
Well, at one point in my life, I might have been considered a sheep in this context. But we're going to talk today about the fact that it's the United States government in Washington, the Pentagon, the Department of Homeland Security, that is leading to the militarization of local police forces. We're hearing today about little towns in Maine. There's a town in Georgia with three policemen that's getting millions of dollars worth of big-time equipment to fight off the terrorists or whatever. And it really has changed the nature of policing and the way police think of themselves and, of course, the way we think about the police.
Okay, look forward to that. Very interesting topic at 1 o'clock on To the Point. And coming up on this program, a rare peek into an iconic Los Angeles home. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
When you're young and rich in Beverly Hills, the fun can last all night. The night can last all day. And the scars can last a lifetime.
Remember that? That's the trailer for the 1987 movie Less Than Zero. Almost three decades later, Less Than Zero is memorable for its stylish look as much as for its plot. And one backdrop from the film particularly stands out, outshining even James Spader's slicked back hair. It's a house perched high on a hill with a curvy metallic roof, an expansive glass wall, an infinity pool. Well, now for an asking price of $7.5 million, it could be yours. It's known as Silvertop, and the house was designed by the influential architect John Lautner. Lautner created dramatic, space-agey homes from the late 40s through the 1980s, and he was a leading figure during Southern California's golden age of modernist design, part of a pact that included Richard Neutra and Rudolf Schindler. Their work helped create what we now consider some of LA's classic landscapes, and with the pending sale of the iconic Silvertop home, we thought it would be a great time to look at Lautner's significance and influence with Alan Hess, an architect, historian, and author of 19 books, including The Architecture of John Lautner. Welcome.
Hello.
Well, tell us more about Silvertop. It seems to be a quintessential Southern California showpiece home. It's in Silver Lake. When was it built, and why did he choose Silver Lake?
Well, it was a long process. It started in 1959. And wasn't really completed until 1974, but there was a very long, involved, and even tragic story in that time that resulted in the final completion of the house. It was in Silver Lake because Silver Lake was really known as probably the most progressive neighborhood. All the really adventurous architects worked in Silver Lake. They were difficult sites, but beautiful sites with views. And actually, Ken Reiner, the owner, an original client of the house, had lived in Silver Lake in a Rudolf Schindler house.
So what was the tragic story that you alluded to?
Well, it started out with the highest of hopes to mate technology with nature. And that's what Southern California and its lifestyle is really all about. Looking to the future and modern technology providing, you know, wonderful lifestyle, but in the midst of our beautiful natural setting. However, despite a really good collaboration between Lautner and Ken Reiner went bankrupt partway through the 1960s. The house was built but not completed. And in fact, Ken Reiner never actually lived in the House. It was only 20-some years later that he actually set foot in the House. He was kind of the ultimate Southern California inventor, entrepreneur related to aerospace. So he was a very visionary man.
Well, in fact, it does make me think of aerospace. That's the look of this house, as well as Chemosphere, another house that John Lautner built. Was he influenced by the industry here in Southern California?
Oh, definitely. Reiner was right in the thick of it, and Lautner was always looking for new inventions, new technology to improve life. And this house is full of ideas. Low-voltage lighting, frameless glass, glass walls that moved at the touch of a button, tunnels underneath it so that you could service the whole building without disturbing life going on inside of it, skylights, noiseless toilets. It just goes on and on, down to the really the very systems that put it all together. And that's where Lautner and Reiner worked together, because they saw it as a laboratory, a laboratory to develop products which could be then mass marketed.
Reiner saw it as that.
Yeah.
And the infinity pool, this was the first one?
It apparently is the first one. And again, it wasn't just a trick of some sort. The idea was when you're in the house looking out over the pool, you see how it connects to Silver Lake below. So you have this sense of infinity, of connection between the pool and the far distance as well.
So Ken Reiner never got to live in it. Who did live in it?
That's the happy part of the tragedy. When Reiner went bankrupt, the house was eventually sold in 1974 to Philip and Jacqueline Burchill. And fortunately, they hired Lautner to complete it. Mr. Burchill died a couple of years ago, and his wife is moving to be near family elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's on the market for the first time, and $7.5 million. Does that seem like a good price to you?
I have friends who think that that is just the best bargain in L.A. right now.
And I'm wondering, you know, you mentioned all these space age designs. Do they hold up?
I think they hold up. I do think that Silvertop is one of the most important, if not the most important, residential design in Southern California. You have other examples like the Case Study Houses or Charles Eames House, which are also high tech, but they don't relate to nature in the way that Lautner, who of course was a student of Frank Lloyd Wright, the way that Lautner connected his houses to nature. So you have this balance of high-tech futurism, but also very earthy, livable nature.
And then he went on to create this other space-age house, Chemosphere. Tell us about that one and how these two homes really exemplified John Lautner.
Silvertop took a long time, but Chemosphere was built about the same time and also incorporated, was a laboratory for new ideas. It's often referred to as a flying saucer, but really that was Lautner's solution to a actually unbillably steep site. So he created one central column and then cantilevered this circular house on top of it, creating just wonderful views, of course, as well.
And did he build any homes for regular people, or was he always building these extravagant designs?
Well, he's known for his huge, extravagant, usually concrete houses. But no, early in his career, in the 40s and the 50s, he designed a series of small houses for average people throughout Southern California, but they also had as much inventiveness and originality as Silvertop or the Chemosphere.
And how has he influenced later architects?
Lautner is a heroic figure. You, as an architecture student, as I was, we would go to his lectures, and he would embody the sense of truth against the world, of doing new things. And he was an inspiration.
And when you look back on it during that time, mid-century, pretty much, you've got John Lautner, you have Richard Neutra, Rudolf Schindler, Charles and Ray Eames, Gregory Ain. I mean, this was the golden age of architecture in Southern California, it seems.
It was. There was a lot of building going on, and Southern California attracted incredibly talented people. But I think it's important to realize just the variety of ideas that all of these talented architects brought. Everything from a Richard Neutra, very precise, austere modernism, to Lautner's very expressive modernism.
Well, I want to thank you very much. It was really interesting.
Sure.
Alan Hess is an architect, historian, and author of 19 books, including The Architecture of John Lautner. Julie Myers is here now with our Tuesday mailbag.
And Madeline is back with us. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Yeah. Today we led the show with some school stuff. As you know, you were here. The fact that Compton School Police will be armed with semi-automatic rifles, and that there was a foiled alleged school shooting at South Pasadena High. We wanted to know what all of you all thought about all of that. On our Facebook page, Shainer Thomas says, "School cops with semi-automatic rifles? Sounds like a great learning environment." Note the sarcasm that was added for effect, but I assume I'm correct in adding it. Mark Lawrence says, "Whoa, how about we start with things like security gates first?" But Brett Houston says, "Hey, if we've got armed guards at banks, are our children any less important?" George called in, he left us a message, and he sort of agreed with Brett here.
"I do believe that a AR-15 in a school is a deterrent, and if needed, it offers more accuracy to reach out and knock down the bad guy."
So that was kind of a crummy phone line, but George votes yay for AR-15s in schools. Richard also called in. He was not on board with rifle-armed cops in schools.
"It is a misuse of government funds, and I think that they need to focus the monies on books and hiring more teachers and lengthening school hours. They need to use that money to educate the children."
So there's a lot of conversation going on our Facebook page, plenty of voicemails, Twitter too. You guys should go check it out.
Go check it out. We are at KCOW Press Play. Thank you, Julie Myers, for that. We'd love to hear from you about anything you want to talk about, not just that topic, but anything you hear on the show. At KCOW Press Play, I'm at The Mad Brand, my personal Twitter. And I think I'm out of here right now. Warren Olney is up next with To The Point, and I'll see you tomorrow.